Okay, so our topic for this season will be the history of anti-Semitism. This is a course that people had requested that I give over the past few years. Multiple times people said, when are you going to give anti-Semitism? Well, I delayed, because it's not exactly the most fun topic or cheerful one, but it's an important topic nonetheless, and it's going to take us a better part of a year to finish it. One second. Okay, so history of anti-Semitism is something that we could, if I wanted to, focus only on the modern period from the origins of the term anti-Semitism, which means the 1850s, 60s, 1870s, and onward. But that would not do justice to the subject matter, because in truth, the term anti-Semitism, while it has become entrenched, is not the be-all and end-all. And in fact, it's a very inappropriate term. After all, who's even a Semite that you should be an anti-Semite? It's really just an issue of hatred of Jews. And that hatred has been around a very long time. So my intention is to cover the whole history of the subject matter from the pagan period, the classical period, the Greco-Roman period, then through the rise of Christianity, through the medieval period, maybe short shifting that a little bit because it's not my area of expertise, and then going into the early modern period of the philosophers, and then the question of the civic emancipation of the Jews, followed by German racial anti-Semitism of the late 19th century, and then up through the Holocaust, and even post-World War II modern anti-Semitism, the so-called new anti-Semitism, which is mostly in the Arab Muslim world, but also in the Western, Western elites. So that's what we intend to cover over the course of the season. Tonight, I want to just do some introductory remarks based upon four books that are good books on the subject matter. I'll show you them. I always like to give my little props here. So the first one is David Berger's edited History and Hate: The Dimensions of Anti-Semitism. The next one is Peter Schaeffer's Judeophobia, which will be important over the next 5 weeks as we cover the classical period. Then Anti-Semitism, a History by Albert Lindemann. And lastly, The Changing Face of Anti-Semitism by one of my favorite writers of all time, Walter LeCour. So what I have to say tonight basically is a summary of their various introductions on the topic more broadly. So let's begin. We shall never fully understand anti-Semitism. It's a deep-rooted, complex, and incessantly persistent, yet constantly changing and remaining nonetheless the same. The term anti-Semitism is inappropriate, yet is so entrenched that it's futile to resist usage of the term. Let me emphasize that. As bad as an inappropriate and inaccurate the term might be, the scholars, and therefore I am no scholar, I'm just teaching for the lay people, I'm not going to bother trying to invent a new term. There are other terms that are thrown around, but without much effect, whether it's Judenhass, Jew hatred, or in the classical period, Judeophobia, or anti-Judaism from the Christian medieval period. But yet, despite the existence of all these terms, anti-Semitism is the one that's popular and is the one that we will generally speaking use. But what does it in fact mean? So one interpretation is, or one definition is, hostility towards Jews as a group, which results from no legitimate cause or greatly exceeds any reasonable ethical response to a genuine provocation. That's one possible definition. Another possible definition is a pejorative perception of Jewish physical or moral traits, which is either utterly groundless or the result of an irrational generalization or exaggeration. But then we have a problem. While those are very nice definitions, when is a cause legitimate and when is a provocation genuine? Meaning, these definitions say you can't hate the Jews too much if it's unjustified. But what if it is justified? And who's to say when it's justified? That's the very basic question in examining all these these case examples of conflict between Jews and Gentiles. Was the Gentile reaction overboard and therefore deserving of our moral opprobrium, or was it quite reasonable because of legitimate provocation? Now, next question is, did Christianity, perpetuate a pre-existing anti-Semitism, or did it create something de novo? If ancient paganism had been replaced by a religion or ideology without an internal anti-Jewish dynamic, it is quite likely that the anti-Semitism of the classical world would have gradually faded. But instead, what happened? It was reinforced because Christianity had that internal anti-Jewish dynamic. So was it continuing something from the past, or was it something new? We're going to spend a bunch of weeks addressing that question. And the scholars to this day are not of one mind about that. Where is there continuity between the pagan period and the Christian period? Now, medieval Christian theology accorded Jews a unique toleration. But at the same time, that very same theology required Jews to undergo unique persecution, meaning of all the non-Christian religions, the only religion that has any right to survive in the eyes of the church is Judaism. But to survive as witness to the truths of Christianity, and that the Jews who are the ones perpetuating Judaism, they get to exist, but to exist in a subservient state, in a debased state. Now, in the early Middle Ages, the tolerant element of this equation predominated. Why? Well, because Europe wasn't really sufficiently Christian yet. That's the basic point. Although the church had come to spread its tentacles all over continental Europe, the population still was not yet so devoted to the theology, and therefore not so devoted to the hatreds associated with that theology. But as Christian piety widened and deepened, the prospect for violent outbursts grew, notably in the Crusades. Also, the fact that Jews were forced into certain professions, notably money lending, did not generate any affection. In the High Middle Ages, there developed notions of national unity, especially in England and France. So then the idea of a monochromatic European Christendom came into play. And that necessitates ousting the Jews. You know, you used to live here? Well, not anymore. We're going to be a totally homogeneous society from a religious perspective. The Jews turn to kings and churchmen for protection, and sometimes they get it and sometimes they don't. And we'll talk about that at some length. The Talmud is burned and expulsions are justified on the grounds that it's a form of tolerance in the sense that no bloodshed happened. We didn't kill you. We let you leave peaceably with your body intact. In the late Middle Ages, the demonization of Jews reached a crescendo. What are some of these forms of demonization? Well, Jewish women give birth to swine. Jews are a product of Adam's liaison with demons. Jews are not descended from the patriarch's seed, but rather from their excrement. All sorts of bizarre and grotesque things emerge from the late Middle Ages. What do we find also in that time period? That the Muranos encountered the beginnings of racial anti-Semitism. Why racial anti-Semitism? They converted. So there's no longer a religious component to it. But what is it? They're different. They were not of the same ethnic stock. And it's not easy for a society to transform its attitude to a previously reviled minority almost overnight. Meaning if I hated you yesterday, it's hard for me to love you tomorrow. And especially if there are 1,000 of you or 10,000 of you, if I hated your guts yesterday, I'm probably going to dislike you still tomorrow. Why? Because you are who you are. And that's the beginnings of racial anti-Semitism, at least in the medieval period. As Christianity declined among the elites of society, anti-Semitism did not. It was a deeply rooted pathology. So in the early modern period, Jews are bankers, but also paupers. Jews are capitalists, but also communists. Jews are nationalists, but also rootless cosmopolitans. Jews are evil geniuses, but also dunces. So whatever you wanted to say about Jews that made them bad or non-desirable or worthy of scorn, you could find whatever you wanted and apply it to them. And in the early modern period, as religion ceases to be all that relevant among the thinkers, they can find other reasons to dislike Jews. Don't give Jews citizenship. Why? They are aliens, or they're a state within a state. So these are some of the criticisms in the period before the discussion about emancipation. We spent a couple of years already discussing the emancipation, and we'll talk about it again some more, but the emancipation was expected to erase Jews as a distinct group. When it failed to do so, certain Gentiles were disgruntled. And part of the resurgence of anti-Semitism was a rebellion against the very liberalism and modernity which were responsible for emancipating the Jews. The unacculturated Jew was a visible enemy with beard and payas. The cultured Jew was even more insidious. So therefore, Jewish acculturation in the eyes of the anti-Semitic Gentile went from being a promise of a better future to actually a threat of a sinister tomorrow. The Nazis picked up on the demonization of the Jew, and they ran with it. Whereas the persecution of political opponents or religious deviants or economic exploiters necessarily has to be done with a modicum of restraint. If you're exterminating vermin, you can do so with ruthless ferocity. So the idea that the Jews are the devil plays a role in the intensity of the persecution from 1933 to 45. Now, then we go to the modern period. This is all from David Berger's introduction. And Berger makes a very important point that the assertion that Arabs as Semites cannot be properly labeled as anti-Semites is an over-literal use of the term and a disingenuous argument that, of course, Arabs can hate Jews, just like Christian Europeans can hate Jews. And the fact that we use the term Semite or anti-Semite in reference to some biblical hero of shame from Genesis chapters 10 through 11, that doesn't really matter. It's beside the point that if you're a Jew hater, in the lexicon of that we have, you're an anti-Semite. Now, in the early modern period, Jews denied their nationalism, and anti-Semites insisted upon its reality. So we're talking about in the 19th century, those reform-oriented Jews or those assimilation-oriented Jews who sought emancipation said, no, we're not a national group. We're just people who live here and we want to be citizens of the country. And it was the anti-Semitic Gentiles that said, no, you are a national group and you cannot be citizens because you don't really belong here. So that was the Jews denying their status, their national status 150 years ago, 200 years ago. Whereas today the roles are reversed. Now the Jew announces their nationalism. They're a Zionist. They're an Israeli citizen. They're a Jewish patriot. And the Gentile, the anti-Semitic Gentiles, rejected as being illegitimate. There cannot be any legitimate Jewish nationalism. So, depending upon what century you live in, the tide can turn and the roles can be reversed. So that was Berger's 15-page introduction to the topic. Now I want to discuss Peter Schaeffer's introduction. Schaeffer's writing Judeophobia, which is the best work on the classical period, the Greco-Roman period of anti-Semitic thought. And he notices something very interesting. So Norman's asking, can you mention the current definition of anti-Semitism recently adopted? So I want to save that for later in the season. I'm not a big fan of that definition that was recently adopted. And it's caused a lot of ongoing controversy in the universities. We'll save it for another time, but I will get to it, I promise. So Schaeffer notices something interesting. He says, the study of classical anti-Semitism emerges on the scene in academia around exactly the same time as modern anti-Semitism emerges as a phenomenon, as a political phenomenon, meaning in the 1870s, 1880s. And he says, it's no coincidence. What was the reason for the overlap? Well, very simple. Modern bigots turn to the ancient past to justify their contemporary bigotry and to say, hey, listen, this is not my chidush, my novelty. There were people who thought like this a long time ago. And instead of demonizing them or chastising them or castigating them for being haters of people, no, they're heroes of the ancient past. And we can use their wisdom in the here and now. So let's save the likes of Manetho or Apion and say, yeah, they were good guys, and we'll learn their lessons. Schaeffer explains that there are two schools of thought about the emergence of anti-Semitism and why it continues to thrive. One school of thought is the essentialist or substantialist school of thought, which basically is that the unique religious, social, and cultural characteristics of Judaism itself are the causes of anti-Semitism. Basically, blame the Jews. That they're different, and it's natural that people are going to dislike them because of the character of their differences. Edward Meyer, who was one of the great German historians of the 19th century, he said that the hatred of Jews is as old as Judaism itself. Now, in that regard, he actually is paraphrasing the Midrash. Because what does the Midrash say? The Midrash says, why is it called Har Sinai? Because what is Sinai? Sinah, that hatred comes down to the world with the giving of the Torah. And, you know, I wrote an essay about that a number of years ago, the rabbinic tradition about anti-Semitism, and we'll spend probably a whole session on that, maybe 3 or 4 weeks from now, the rabbinic view of the origins of anti-Semitism. But here we're saying that the essentialist view is that Judaism makes the Jews different. The Jews are different. Therefore, it's inevitable people are going to dislike them. Now, what makes them different? Their bizarre attitudes, superstitious rites, arrogant presumptuousness, and spiteful aloofness to all others. That's a mouthful. All right. Theodore Mommsen, another of the big scholars of that time, said the hatred of Jews is as old as the diaspora itself. Now, this is an interesting distinction, a chiluk. One perspective is hatred of Jews is as old as Judaism. The other is it's as old as the diaspora. Which one makes more sense? Well, before the diaspora, Judaism was confined to Eretz Yisrael, and Jews essentially not interacting with others. It's a national religion in its own homeland. So why should there be necessarily any hostile attitudes from outsiders if they're not interacting with them? All right, so therefore, maybe the origins of the diaspora in the 586 or even 722 or what have you is a better time frame for the origins of ill feelings towards Jews. Okay. Another perspective, the essence of Judaism, rigid, exclusive, and malevolent towards others, could only have been met with revulsion by the naturally tolerant Greeks. Now, that's an interesting idea, that Greeks are tolerant and the Jews are intolerant. Well, on the specific issue of theology, there's a lot of truth to that. After all, how many gods do the Jews believe in? One. And Kael Kana is a jealous god, zealous god, which means you can't have any other ones. And not only the Jews are not supposed to have any other ones, but at least as Rabbinic Judaism interpreted the Bible, even the Goyim can't have any other gods. So, and if you do, you're worthy of death, Chai of Misa. Whereas the Greek perspective is sort of live and let live theologically. I believe in a whole bunch of deities, you could believe in other deities, and they're all in the same pantheon, and all is wonderful. So there is a certain tolerance level that that Hellenistic civilization will evince that the Jews never did. Okay. Now, Marcel Simon said the basic cause of Greco-Roman anti-Semitism was Jewish separatism, which was caused by religion. Am levadad yishkon, the people that dwells alone. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, I mean, from the standpoint of the survival of Judaism, we think that cloistering ourselves really does help, and it does, because too much of an openness to the wider society results in the demise of Judaism. But it also means that we develop a certain parochial attitude, which may be felt by others to be hostile and arrogant and nasty. Okay, Victor Cherikover, one of the great Jewish scholars of the last 100 years, said that the Jews are alien to other people because they are foreigners from another land. And they are alien because they are foreign customs which are strange and outlandish in the eyes of the local inhabitants. So what Cherikover is hitting on is something that even the Chazal were aware of, that certain aspects of Judaism look funny to an outsider. Right? You shake a tree and a lemon on Sukkot, it looks funny. And that's the least of the funny things. There are things that are even more bizarre, that to us might not be bizarre, but to someone else from 1,000 miles away in a very different cultural milieu will think, what are they doing? All right. So that's the essentialist school that says we do weird things, we have hostile attitudes, therefore the Goyim are going to dislike us. But the other school is the functionalist school of thought. The functionalist school of thought says that ancient anti-Semitism was not based on the essence of Judaism, however defined, but rather on very concrete political conflicts, meaning we're at odds with the others, the non-Jews, over real world things, olam hazeh kind of issues, not olam haba kind of issues, political fights, economic fights, and they happen in discrete locations. You can identify and pinpoint where they are and what's going on. And what are the three foci in the classical period? One was Eretz Israel or Syria-Palestine or Syria-Judea. The other is Egypt. Egypt would be a big one. And the third is Rome. And we're going to discuss in turn, I think in separate weeks, each of those three. What's happening, where is the conflict, and what is the conflict about in each of those three locations? So when does this political conflict emerge? What century? What was happening to create this ill will, according to the functionalist school? So one perspective is Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, and his crusade of Hellenization that negatively affected Eretz Yisrael and the origins of the Hanukkah story. Some say it's a little later than that. It's the Hasmonean rebellion in reaction to that. Others say it's that the expansion of the Hasmonean state. Now, the expansion of the Hasmonean state came at the expense of whom? Of Gentiles, of the Idumeans, the Iturians, and they were forcibly converted. Others say it emerges with the arrival of Rome as a power in the ancient Near East and the reversal of the hierarchy between Greeks and Jews, that whereas Greeks were on top and Jews were on the bottom, all of a sudden the Jews are aligned with the Romans and they're on top of the Greeks. And that creates machlokas and real, you know, visceral hatred. Okay. In the post-World War II era, another school of thought emerged, and Leon Poliakov, who wrote a three-volume history of anti-Semitism, I would suggest people take a look at it. It's available on Amazon. Poliakov and Jules Isaac, among other scholars, claim that pagan anti-Semitism and Christian anti-Judaism are in no way compatible, with the latter being much worse, meaning blame the church. Don't look to the classical period and the Greeks and the Romans to try to explain why, even in the here and now, people still hate the Jews. That happened a long time ago. It's kind of irrelevant. It's old news. The real reason is Christian anti-Judaism. And then start from there and move to the present. Peter Schaeffer in Judeophobia uses the term Judeophobia, although he didn't invent the term, actually. He just borrowed it. And he rejects both the essentialist and the functionalist theories and claims that neither of those exist in pristine form. I think Schaeffer is right. I wrote an essay about 5 years ago, and maybe one of you reading this, listening tonight, of the 35 of you listening at home, remember this essay. Remember I wrote about eating on Hanukkah, feasting on Hanukkah, Hanukkah 2016. If you save your old emails on Thoughts in the Parsha, so Hanukkah 2016, I wrote an essay, Feasting on Hanukkah, and I started with the premise that, it's a mitzvah to eat a suda on Purim, right? It's mitzvah, but is there a mitzvah to eat a suda on Hanukkah? So the answer is no. And yet the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah says, nonetheless, it's a mitzvah, tzas, it's a minor mitzvah to increase your food intake, to have a latke, to have a donut, you know, something like that. Why? Because it's a holiday, it's good to eat a little something. Now, what's the conventional reason why we eat on Purim, but we don't necessarily eat on Hanukkah? Who wants to unmute themselves and tell me why we eat Purim but not Hanukkah? Who knows? Nobody wants to take a venture a guess?
It was a suda that the Jews went to in Persia.
Ah, so that's one of the terutzim, you're right. But the conventional terutz that you probably learned in Cheder is the one given by the Lavush. The Lavush says that on Purim, they tried to kill us physically. So therefore, we respond by celebrating physically with a feast. Hanukkah, they tried to destroy our souls and our spirits with Hellenization. So we respond with a spiritual act of lighting candles, but not a physical act of eating and feasting. That's the classic explanation that you probably have heard at some point or another. It's offered by the Lavush around the year 1600. However, I wrote an essay basically saying it's not true. That if you look even in the Rishonim, and certainly in the literature book before the Rishonim, it's perfectly clear that when it comes to Purim, the story of Esther, there was a religious component. V'dateihem shonot mikolam, their religion is different from everybody else's religion. V'tateihem melech enam osim, and they don't do the religion of the king. And in the Targum, the Aramaic translation of the Megillah, there's a whole long story about how they how Haman tells Achashverosh, they go to their synagogues and they curse the king, and they say Shema, they say Shemon Esrei, they read the Torah, the Haftarah, and they curse the king, and their religion is terrible. So let's get rid of their religion. So Purim is also about anti-Judaism. And when it comes to Hanukkah, what does the Rambam say? Not just that they tried to, the Antiochus tried to destroy our religion, but they also tried to destroy our bodies. That they tried to steal our money and rape our daughters. You know, there's a physical aspect of it too. So therefore what? You should have a spiritual celebration on Purim in addition to the feasting. And you should have a feast on Hanukkah in addition to the spiritual celebration. It's both. And I say it always is both. It's never one or the other. It always is a combination of the two. You can't have the functionalist school without the essentialist school or vice versa. So that's, you know, my spiel in agreement with Schaeffer, basically opposing sort of the doctrinaire approaches that it's one or the other. Okay. Now let's go to the third book for tonight, Lindemann's book, A History of Anti-Semitism, this one. So he starts with a line from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. The dividing line between good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. What's the point of that line? Why is he quoting it? Why is that the opening line of a book about anti-Semitism? Because what he's saying is, you're not going to be able to divide the world between the good guys who love the Jews, sort of the Philo-Semites, and the bad guys who hate the Jews, the anti-Semites. There's no clean break between one and the other. You're going to find a lot of overlap. You're going to find that Philo-Semitism can morph into anti-Semitism, and sometimes anti-Semitism can be manifested in a person who also does favorable things to Jews. That in one day you're a Baal Chesed and you save people from persecution, and the other day you say a nasty comment about how Jews are all, you know, devilish fiends. That there's no clear break between one and the other. He notes an interesting idea. Self-proclaimed anti-Semites themselves have argued over what the term means and what it should mean. It's one thing that the Jews don't know, or the scholars, the academic scholars don't know what anti-Semitism means and try and struggle to define it. But even the vicious anti-Semites themselves don't agree with what it means. Machlokes among the bad guys. Concerning anti-Semitism, Lindemann says, we should quote Potter Stewart. I know it when I see it. Okay? Like Potter Stewart said about pornography, I know it when I see it. What causes anti-Semitism? So some say the Jews must change. And some say the Gentiles must undergo introspection, cheshbon ha-nefesh, and reform. Some will say that both sides need to change. And then when you say that, both sides say, no, no, it's the other guy's fault. Some say it's God's will. Now, this is where we get to theology and even Jewish theology. And I want to spend, as I said, I'm going to spend some time on the rabbinic perspective of anti-Semitism. In this perspective, God uses anti-Semitic Gentiles as his hand in punishing and bludgeoning the Jews for failing to abide by the Sinaitic covenant, by the covenant of Har Sinai. Who believes that? What kind of Jew believes that? Well, a doctrinaire Orthodox Jew might believe that. But as Lindemann points out, it's not only doctrinaire Orthodox Jews who believe it. Even secular Jews can say the same sort of thing. Isaac Bashevis Singer, who was a Chazar Fresser and certainly no Frum Yid, what did he say? Only in the exile did the Jews grow spiritually, meaning that there is a certain chastening of the Jew, an expanding of the Jew's horizon as a result of persecution in Chutz La'aretz, in the diaspora, and that anti-Semitism has something of a salutary effect because it makes us into better people. Okay, some people see anti-Semitism like they see criminality. It's deeply rooted, mysterious, and incurable. Lord Acton famously said, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we need to use Lord Acton's comment in assessing the relationship between Jews and Gentiles and where we stand on anti-Semitism. There's an imbalance of power between Jews and Gentiles when the Jews are a diasporic people without, you know, any political sovereignty anywhere in the world and without political rights anywhere in the world. The essentialist view is that of the powerful Gentile. Namely, it's the Jew's fault. The functionalist view is basically that of the defenseless Jew. It's the Gentile's fault. You know, it's not my fault, but the circumstances dictated that they would hate us. The theological view is unacceptable to the academic historian. The academic historian doesn't want to hear that God up in Shemayim is using Hitler or Stalin or Khmelnytsky or fill in the blank anti-Semitic figure as a tool of the Ribono Shel Olam in chastening the Jews. You know, you can't go that route when you're an academic. But even for the believing layperson, the theological view can be abhorrent, especially if applied after the Holocaust. You know, if you try to say that the Nazis were the hand of God in punishing Am Yisrael for their transgressions, right? You're venturing in the realm of a certain firebrand preacher from Muncie, who I'm not going to say his name, Yimach Shemo, who says those sorts of things. You can't get away with saying that even if you believe it. And the most Jews are not going to want to believe it. They shouldn't believe it. So the theological view has its limits. Okay. Sometimes Jews dramatize and overstate their suffering. That's been a criticism. And they cry wolf. But it should be noted that this is sometimes a method of self-preservation. You cry wolf because it's effective. And in an environment where people are sensitive, even Gentiles are sensitive to the cry of anti-Semitism, sometimes it works. Of course, it can backfire. You can cry wolf too many times and it stops working even when it's real. Okay. The Zionists internalized the essentialist argument. So basically, Herzl said that in the Galut, Jews developed certain objectionable traits, objectively detestable traits. So was Herzl an anti-Semite? No. But Herzl had the same thinking as the anti-Semites about the current state of affairs. His solution was bring them to a Jewish state somewhere in the world, whether it's Israel or elsewhere. For some anti-Semites, tolerance of Jews would be a mistake. You know, tolerance is always seen as a good thing, but you can only tolerate so much. If the Jews are an objectively dangerous threat to society, then you have to stamp them out. So anti-Semitic action is a matter of self-defense and moral probity, if you really believe it. 19th century defenders of the Jews took a salt in the soup approach. What's the salt in the soup approach? A little bit of salt flavors the soup. Too much salt ruins the soup. So a sprinkling of Jews in continental Europe adds a little cultural flavor to an otherwise boring and homogeneous Christian Europe. But too much Jews, too much salt in the soup, it ruins continental Europe. It Judaifies it, and that's bad. So, and those are the defenders of Jews, the good guys, so to speak. They say, a little bit is fine, but too much, it's a little too much. Okay. Now, Christians demonized Jews in a variety of ways. We mentioned a few of them a few minutes ago, but let's mention a few more. Cannibalism, the poisoning of wells, the draining of blood for ritual purposes, spreading of plague, deicide, desecration of the host. So all these are reasons for the believer, the true believer, to really hate the Jews. What stops the believing Christian from acting out on that anger and hatred in the most severe of ways? Well, the fact that Jesus was a Jew and the apostles were Jews means that the demonization of Jews as a physical entity has its limits. They're bad, but you can't say that they are racially bad or, physically to the core, need to be extirpated from the earth, because after all, the founder of your faith was one of them. Wilhelm Marr, who popularized the term anti-Semitism, rejected the Christian demonization of the Jews. But to be honest, as much as he wanted to think that his views were very scientific and modern, they were actually quite primitive. And modern anti-Semitism was seen as less about factual evidence about the Jews and more about pre-existing attitudes. So even Gentiles who didn't subscribe to this, they said, yeah, Marr and his cohort are not dealing in the realm of fact. They're dealing in the realm of fantasy. So why were Jews, why were Gentiles angry about Jews? So one of the reasons is Jewish pretension of divine favor. Elie Wiesel speaks about this notion of romimut, elevation, the loftiness of the Jews, that they're ontologically different. By the way, whenever anyone uses the word ontologically, it's a bubba meiser. That word means nothing in my view. Okay. Now, so what are some of the terms that are thrown around by Jews that get Gentiles offended in this regard? Am Nivchar, the chosen people, Goy Kadosh, a holy nation, or the very text of the Havdalah. But even secular Jews tend to believe that there's a difference between Jews and Gentiles. One of the common refrains is that Jews are just like everyone else, only more so. It's really offensive. It's a nice, funny line, but it's offensive if you're not Jewish. Okay, so were all Jews this way, aloof, and interested in preserving our own elitist status with regard to God and divine favor? No, not necessarily. We can spend some time over the next few weeks distinguishing between the Ezra tradition and the Ruth tradition. What's the difference between the Ezra tradition and the Ruth tradition? Who wants to tell me? Ezra versus Ruth?
I don't know.
Nobody wants to tell me? So Ezra kicked out the foreign wives. He kicked out the foreign wives. He's an absolute purist, genealogical purity. don't let the other involved in our community. Whereas Ruth's approach is, converts are good. A Moabitess can be welcomed into the neighborhood, and we don't have to be at arm's length from everybody. One of the important things to recognize as we study anti-Semitism is that one man's villain is another man's hero. We're going to speak ill of certain historical figures, and others in a different setting, instead of a synagogue adult ed program and a church adult ed program, might be calling these people the Gedolim and their heroes. So, for example, St. John Chrysostom or Martin Luther or Bogdan Khmelnytsky will be revered by Catholics, Protestants, and Ukrainians respectively, but they will be regarded by us as the worst of the worst, Yamach Shemam V'Zichram, they should rot in hell, sort of thing. So our villain is their hero. Keep that in mind. There's a notion that the anti-Semites on the whole were petty losers. One of the reasons for that is the idea that Hitler was a failed artist and a real nothing from nowhere. That by the end of World War I, he was a zero in life. And that in general, who become anti-Semites? People who failed. The ones who were stuck in their mother's basement on 4chan and the right-wing websites, with the neo-Nazi websites, they're sort of the loser type. That's the thinking. All anti-Semites are failures. But it's not really true. We're going to discuss as the weeks go along that plenty of the great men of European civilization said horrible things about Jews, including the great philosophers and political leaders. And we're going to have to address the fact that even people who sometimes did favorable things for Jews also said nasty comments, including the likes of Lord Balfour, Winston Churchill, and President Harry Truman. Last year we did American Jewish History. We discussed Truman at length in that regard. Okay. Well, the Jewish question was a 19th century idea, among several other political questions that had to be answered. It assumed that a problem existed, but also that there could be the problem could be resolved favorably. The question was, do the Jews have the desire and the capacity to be citizens of the modern nation state with equal rights and responsibilities? For the answer to be yes, significant religious, economic, and social and practical reforms would have to be undertaken, meaning you, the Jews, as you are now in 1820, cannot be citizens, but you might be different by 1920 or 2020, and then you'll be deserving of full rights and equality. Another question. While the Gentiles had a Jewish question, there were times when the Jews had a Gentile question. What was the solution? Well, when did Jews have a Gentile question? In the days of Joshua, Sefer Yehoshua. What was his solution? The physical extermination of the Canaanites. Not exactly very pleasant. Or in the days of Ezra, rigorous religious separatism, get rid of the foreign wives. Or in the days of the Hasmoneans, forced conversion. So the Jews don't necessarily have the best record or most tolerant record when we had the upper hand against the other guy, just like we complained that they didn't have a good record when they had the upper hand against us. Who is the first anti-Semite, at least in the biblical sense? Pharaoh. Hava nitchak malo. We have to outsmart the Jews. So that makes him, in Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim, what happened to the ancestors happened to the children. We find over the generations, b'chol dor v'dor tim leno chaloteinu, like we say in the Seder. In every generation, they rise up to oppress us. So, hava nitchak malo, the wily anti-Semite, the Gentile thinks that the Jews are wily and clever. But the Jew thinks that the Gentile is wily and clever in trying to keep us down. Also, v'achbed et libo, God hardens the heart of Pharaoh. So this is the origin of the idea that God plays a role here in manipulating the anti-Semite to be a tool in the divine plan to prosecute the offending Jew. Okay. Well, next week, we're going to spend some time on Yetzias Mitzrayim, the story as we tell it and the story as the anti-Semites told it, Manetho in Egypt in the 3rd century BCE, the counter narrative. So that's going to be one of several topics we'll cover in the coming weeks about why in the classical world, they didn't like the Jews. The intellectuals might not have liked the Jews. We're going to discuss the Exodus narrative. We're going to discuss the Sabbath, the abstention from pork, xenophobia and misanthropy, and a few other topics. And the notions of God, notions of monotheism. So Jews are different. How are they different? Well, what about in the Purim story? Haman says they're different. But he doesn't specify how. He just says the Jews don't keep the laws of the king. Which laws? Doesn't say. Because, fill in the blank, in every generation, it could be a different law. Sort of it's a blank, it's not a blank slate, but it's a boilerplate language, and you fill in with the details as you need them. Martin Luther thought that the Jews would follow him after he rejected the Catholic readings of the Bible. But the Jews didn't follow Luther, and so he hated them. So that's another example. We're going to see a few of those, where people have ideas of what the Jews should believe in, and they think that the Jews will believe in, if only I get to speak to them and preach to them. But then when after the speaking and preaching happens, the Jews don't become convinced, that person becomes a vicious hater. How could you reject me? I have such a compelling argument, and you don't accept it? Must be you're the devil. Okay. The philosophers, like the likes of Voltaire, we'll get to that maybe in 4 or 5 months from now. Voltaire, he reads the Bible with a malevolent hermeneutic. He thinks the Bible is terrible, that it has a tribal God, a cruel and vindictive God, and the Bible is not a source of morality or chesed, as the rabbis would say. The Bible is a source of viciousness and evil. So, because the Bible is terrible, it means Judaism is terrible, and Christianity is also terrible, but he doesn't talk about that because he doesn't want to get in trouble. In any event, Voltaire and the philosophers are no friends of the Jews. As the century progresses, we get to Moses Mendelssohn, and he's dealing with people who want to suppress Judaism and suppress Jewish rights. And he says, you know, listen, the Gentiles tied our hands behind our backs. And then they complain, how come you don't use your hands? Why are you not productive? You're non-productive. You make money off of petty trading. Use your hands. But they don't let us use our hands. The guilds are closed to us and the like. Okay. The opponents of emancipation said that if you give rights too quickly to the Jews, then their vengefulness and their destructive forces will overtake society. So therefore, you can't give Jews rights too quickly. Even if it's going to happen eventually, it's got to be a slow process. It can't be quick. Christian Wilhelm von Dohm, and we've discussed him many times in the past, argued that the moral failings of the Jews will diminish if you treat them fairly and give them full rights. So basically, even the defenders of Jews are saying, yeah, morally they stink, but they'll get better if we give them fair treatment. Okay. One of the things we're going to see over the coming months is differences between countries. For example, France versus Russia. In France, they emancipated the Jews right away. In Russia, they didn't emancipate the Jews at all. Not until the Soviet Union, and then the Soviet Union enslaved all their population in a totalitarian state. So anti-Semitism differs here versus there. It will also differ in Russia, in Germany, Austria on the one hand, where there's a largely racial component, versus Poland and Russia on the other hand, where it's religious in nature. Okay. And then you have the Habsburg Empire, where you have a monarch like Franz Josef, who loved his Jews and the Jews loved him, but you could have a mayor of Vienna in the same city, Karl Luger, who's a vicious bigot and anti-Semite. Okay. Now, the new anti-Semitism is something we'll eventually get around to later in the year. And that's what parades around as anti-Zionism. In the Arab and the Muslim world, they adopted the protocols of the Elders of Zion and other propaganda emanating from Christian Europe. They adopted it wholeheartedly, not because it's a backward society and they'll very easily fall for a Naresh Kaitan. The demonization of Israel is regarded by many as a backhanded compliment, that whereas the European left or the Western left requires a certain standard of moral behavior from Israel as a Jewish state, it doesn't require it from the Arab states or the Muslim world more broadly. Why? Well, because you're one of us, you the Jews, whereas they're, you know, backward and primitive, so we don't demand much of them. Now, is that fair? That's not fair at all. Is it really what they believe? I'm not sure, but it's what's often said. One of the things that we'll discuss eventually when we get to Palestinian anti-Semitism, and more broadly Arab anti-Semitism, is ideas of rational versus irrational anti-Semitism. I wrote an essay about this 9 years ago for Parshas Balak. Parshas Balak. The title of the essay was Rational Anti-Semitism. I think it may even be in my book. I forget if that's one of the essays in the book. And basically what I said was we have to distinguish between Balak and Bilam. Balak is afraid of the Jews. What does it say in Parshas Balak? It says, Vayar Balak ben Zippor, Okay, they were afraid. They were petrified. They were quaking in their boots. He thinks that they're going to swallow up Moab. That Bnei Yisrael, they defeated Sichon and Og, the giants of the Transjordan, so they're going to swallow us up. So rational anti-Semitism is, we have a conflict, and I think the Jews are going to beat me. So I dislike them, I'm going to fight back. I'm going to try to defend myself by whatever means I can. Irrational anti-Semitism is that of Bilam. Bilam has no beef. He's the third guy in a fight. You know, in hockey, when two guys are fighting and a third guy pounces, who gets the 10-minute penalty? The third guy, not the first two guys fighting. Why? Because there's no reason for the third guy to get involved. It's not his fight. So that's Bilam. He comes from Petor all the way up in the river, all the way in the middle of nowhere, and he's hired, there's a hired goon to curse the Jews, and he does so, but he fails and he blesses them instead. The point is that he didn't need to do this. So his hatred is totally unjustifiable. In modern times, what does that mean? That means that if you live in Nablus or Hebron or Jericho or Gaza, and you hate Jews and you hate Israel, it means that you're Balak, okay? And, you know, you'll be the enemy of the Jewish people, and I, as a partisan Jew and Zionist, I'm not going to like you and want to defeat you, but I understand why you don't like me. As opposed to sort of an intersectional person from the Western world who has no dog in the race, and yet you choose to hate the Jews, so you're Bilam, and I have to defeat you with no mercy. Okay. Now let's go to the last of the four books I want to review tonight, Walter LeCour's Changing Face of Anti-Semitism. So LeCour, he says like this, was there anti-Semitism in the classical period, or was it normal xenophobia? You know, xenophobia is like a dirty word. We're not supposed to be xenophobic, but most people are. And in the ancient world, it wasn't even seen as a sin. It was basically the way the world functions. So was the dislike of Jews any different from the dislike of one nation for another? Was there anything special about it? That's a question he asks, and he doesn't necessarily give a definitive answer. Then he asks, is there continuity between medieval religious anti-Semitism and modern racial anti-Semitism? And, you know, later in the book, he tries to offer some solutions to that, but we'll discuss that at length as the year goes along. In the ancient world, anti-Semitism was one of many ethnic antagonisms. And he claims that the chosenness of the Jewish people caused significant resentment, and the Jewish invention of monotheism caused resentment. Because whereas today we take for granted that Jews should be proud of themselves, that they invented monotheism, in the ancient world, that was no mitzvah, that was no good deed. It was seen as a negative to have only one God. Come on, one God is like being an atheist. You have to have a lot of gods. Okay. Also, he stresses, Judaism rejected two major world religions. Since that's true, it's inevitable. A lot of people, billions of people, are not going to be happy with us. Okay, if we had rejected some minor denomination in the middle of nowhere that doesn't have any sway on the world stage, then we wouldn't be so hated. But we rejected the two major world religions, so they're not going to like us. Okay. Also, he focuses on the fact that Jews are a minority everywhere, or were before the state of Israel. And unlike the Kurds, who found themselves basically centrally located in one part of the world, across a few borders, but roughly in one spot, the Jews were in a lot of different places and nowhere anywhere close to the majority. Because the Jews were major beneficiaries of social and political change of the 19th century, LeCour argues that they were also blamed for the negative consequences of those changes. LeCour mentions that Wilhelm Marr, attacked the Jewish spirit as being a nefarious influence on Germany, and he liked the term anti-Semitism. He didn't coin it, but he liked it and he popularized it. But the Nazis did not like the term anti-Semitism. Can anyone guess why the Nazis did not like the term anti-Semitism?
The Arabs were their partners.
Correct, correct. Very good. They did not want to offend the Arabs. And so the Germans relied upon Arab cooperation in Iraq, in Syria, Lebanon, theoretically, even in Eretz Yisrael with the Mufti. So because you don't want to make fun of the Semites, they didn't like the word anti-Semitism. Jewish defense organizations were founded in Germany in the 1890s, and we spoke about this a number of years ago, the Verein. And they tried to show with facts and figures that the Jews are good for the country. We do our fair share. We don't shirk our military responsibilities. But the anti-Semites didn't care about that. They don't care that the Jews won a bunch of Nobel Prizes and increased the prestige of the German state with their various victories. No. All they cared about was there are no Jewish peasants. You're not farming the land. You're just you're not lifting anything heavier than a pencil. In the modern period, socialists were very optimistic about the disappearance of the Jewish problem. They regarded anti-Semitism as the socialism of fools. And all socialist parties rejected anti-Semitism. But others, understood that anti-Semitism is here to stay, and that the Jewish problem doesn't have any easy solution. The Zionist perspective, whether that of Leo Pinsker with auto emancipation or Theodor Herzl with the Judenstaat, acknowledge that we have a ghost-like status. We're different because we're nowhere the majority. We have to become a majority somewhere, and until that happens, it's quite likely that we'll be detested and reviled. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, we'll get to that late in the season. That was popular in the pre-World War I era, mostly in Tsarist Russia. After World War I, it was popularized in continental Europe and then in the Muslim world. But why did the protocols become believable? Well, they became believable because Jews, or people who had been born Jewish or of Jewish ethnic stock, seemed to be taking over the world. Plenty of the leadership of the Bolshevik and Menshevik parties were Jews. Stalin could be made a Jew if you really wanted to. If you wanted to besmirch the Jews and say that Judeo-Bolshevism is taking over the world, you could say Stalin's great-grandfather was a Jew. No, he wasn't, but you can make up anything you want. Because after all, you could say Lenin had a Jewish grandmother, or Trotsky was a full-fledged Jew named Bronstein, or Kamenev and Zinoviev. You could say whatever you like. Also, in countries west of the Soviet Union, you did have close encounters with a communist takeover in Bavaria, in Hungary, Belakun. So there were Jews or people of Jewish background who deigned to take over European countries in the aftermath of World War I. So it was very tempting to believe the protocols and the notion of a Jewish takeover. In the 1930s, as the Nazis rose to power and anti-Semitism became potentially genocidal, there were some Gentile scholars who decided it was time to take a serious look at the origins of anti-Semitism from a perspective of this is bad and we got to stop this before it's too late. The one who's most notably associated with that trend is James Parks. So I'm showing you now the conflict between the church and the synagogue, the study in the origins of anti-Semitism. Anyone who went to Yeshiva University and took Jewish history, classical Jewish history or medieval Jewish history with Professor Landman of blessed memory or Professor Rosenzweig of blessed memory was supposed to read this whole book. Mostly nobody did. You skipped the readings, but everybody was assigned to read that book. And this was James Parks was a Protestant minister in England in the 30s who said, hey, this is getting out of hand. We have to study the origins of anti-Semitism and get and cut it out. Okay. Until 1945, anti-Semites didn't mind being called anti-Semites. In fact, it was a badge of honor. If you felt that way, you were proud to feel that way and to be known to feel that way. After 1945, people are usually indignant about being called an anti-Semite. Oh, that's not me. That's the other guy. I'm not an anti-Semite. I just have a problem with Israel, or I just think that, Jews have too much power in the United States, but I'm not an anti-Semite. So there's a change in attitude or a willingness to concede the point about your identity as a Jew hater. New anti-Semitism, the so-called new anti-Semitism, was a term first used in the 1970s. At first, it was applied to neo-Nazis of the right-wing variety. Then it was quickly transformed into applying to the Arab anti-Semitism and left-wing anti-Semitism in America and in Europe. LaCour offers an interesting thought experiment, and with this I'll close and then take some questions. What if the Ottoman Empire had collapsed not in 1917 or 18, but in 1817 or 1818? What would have happened then? What if there was a Jewish state of 50 million strong that was established 150 years ago, as opposed to 70 years ago, and there had been no Holocaust, and the Jewish state extended from the Nile to the Euphrates and had oil resources and a strong military and a large, you know, massive civilian population? Would there be anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism under those conditions? And he theorizes that no, there'd be almost no anti-Semitism, and there'd be no anti-Zionism, because Israel would be the Saudi Arabia of the world, and you couldn't fight with them. That why do people pick on Israel or pick on the Jews? Because Israel is weak. It's a small country, 8 million people or 5 million people when the book was written. And it's surrounded by a sea of Arabs with a lot of oil. The Jews have no natural resources. So had the Ottoman Empire collapsed a century earlier, Israel and the Jews would not suffer from the moral criticism that their nationalism, their colonialism happened too late. Their colonialism would have happened in time. And it would have been seen as morally just and powerful and strong, and you couldn't fight it. It's a very interesting theory. It's, you know, in the counterfactual scenario, the subjunctive. But he brings it up just to question, you know, why is there anti-Semitism? Why is there anti-Zionism? What if the world had, you know, world history had happened in a different way? So to end with, there's no monocausal basis for anti-Semitism. There are a lot of different reasons. We're going to spend a year examining it. We're going to start the earliest phases. We'll try to work our way all the way through. And now I'll take any questions on what I've discussed so far.
You mentioned four different books for four different opinions as to causes of anti-Semitism. Seems to me very unimportant, because I would think that all of those elements apply in all cases in all ages.
Well, so we're going to see that certain reasons for Jew hatred do apply in almost every scenario. Other reasons will, you know, wax and wane in their relative importance, depending upon the century and the location. And it's important to be, correctly identify which of these factors is applicable in any given scenario. So obviously, charges of deicide are not going to matter in the Greco-Roman pagan world, because they don't believe in the Jews killed the god. Or the poisoning of wells is, you know, not going to be relevant in 19th century questions over emancipation. There it's going to be questions about whether Jews are ready for civic responsibility. So there are a lot of calumnies, a lot of ways to besmirch the Jews, some of which are used here, some of which are used there, and they have to be fought off in each in turn. Tina.
Oh, hi. I have a question. The Tfilav Aleinu, the Shabbat.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm curious whether the words used was in response to how Jews were perceived and how they suffered, or did the words cause the resentment? In other words, I don't know what came first, the chicken or the egg.
So the wording of Jewish liturgy. Yes, yeah, so the wording of the liturgy is certainly not what is causing the resentment. The fact that Jews may have a hostile attitude towards pagan, towards idol worshippers, is a known thing, and that may precipitate the idol worshipper or the Christians, the Trinitarian Christians' hatred of Jews. The liturgy is just one line in a prayer book, sort of after the fact, when everyone knows what the lay of the land is. And then the question is, will you know, Gentile authorities censor the prayer book because they don't like it? But it's definitely not the case that the liturgy is causing the problem. The problem is already known.
So this is a response, because now it's interesting, in the prayer of Aleinu, in parentheses, it says, Shehema Shachavim Lekel.
Avarik, yeah.
Now that week's has been accepted now, you could say it, but in the Middle Ages, you couldn't say that.
So in the days when there were
dancers.
Guards at the door. There were people supervising the Jewish worship services and ratting on them to the authorities. That sort of line could put the community in a heap of trouble. Whereas by the late 18th century, the guards at the door are no longer relevant.
Did the non-Jewish world play up that the Jews wanted to be kept separate, keep themselves separate from everybody else, going back even to the time of Goshen?
Yes. So Jewish refusal to do three things really offended the Gentile authorities and the Hamonam, the masses, at various points in time. One was the lack of commensality. You can't eat together. We have kashrus, and we reinforce kashrus with notions of bishul akum and chalav akum and pas akum. And they can't even cook our food, let alone we can't eat with them. So that's one area, the lack of commensality. The other was the lack of fornication between Jew and Gentile. The idea of, people are supposed to, only engage in sexual relations with their spouse, but why are Jews not willing to engage sexually with the Gentile? What are we diseased? They won't be with us. So that offended people. And thirdly, the refusal to participate in civic religious rituals. That the Jews said, we are absolute monotheists, and we can't engage in civic religion, even in a token way, a symbolic way of, throwing a couple of grains of rice on the statue of whomever. We can't do it. And so the Gentiles get offended. Why can't you do it? Why can't you be part of everybody else? Well, you're so distant and aloof from us. So those are three different ways, food, sexuality, and worship, but probably there are others that played a role.
Okay, Next week is in the shul.
Okay, so we'll stop now. Throughout the season, we'll be on Zoom, but starting next Tuesday, at least for the Woodmere folks, it'll be in person. Okay? All right, 8:15 Tuesdays. Everyone have a good night. Take care.
You too. You will.
Thanks so much.